Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. The opposite of spoiled. How's that for an aspirational book title when it comes to kids and money? We'll talk to its author, Ron Lieber, for some ideas on conversations to have and practices to embrace to raise financially independent kids. And get smarter about money. The online resource from the Ontario Securities Commission has been redesigned and has even more to help you get a handle on your investments. Then, a changing mindset for home sellers in some Toronto neighborhoods as the market shifts. Plus, small businesses have a new financing option thanks to a new Canadian fintech. That's ahead. Let's get started. My daughter is 7 years old. I cover personal finance for a living, so I feel a certain pressure to walk the talk when it comes to kids and money. I am pretty vested, both personally and professionally, in this next interview. Ron Lieber is a columnist for the New York Times and the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Hello there, Ron.
Hello.
You are joining us from Brooklyn, New York. I hope having a bit of summer vacation with your kids, yes?
It is going to happen if it kills us. Work is trying to get in the way. My wife works at the Times as well. But we are definitely going to get away together for a whole 9 days later in the month.
Wow, awesome. I hope you talk about everything other than money during those 9 days, unless you have to like budget for ice cream cones and things like that. I want to start with this anecdote from your three-year-old daughter. She asked you a big question. Why don't we have a summer house? She was three. You say she was three. What do you say to that?
I said absolutely nothing. I was stunned into silence there in the front seat of the car when she sprung forth from the back with that question. Apropos of nothing, it literally came out of nowhere. We were not contemplating buying a second home. We could not afford one. We cannot afford one now. So we really had no idea where it came from. My wife, of course, thought this was hysterical, right? It's like I played Dr. Money in the newspaper every single weekend. And I had no idea what to say to this kid, but I knew it was important, right? She had sensed that there were other people in the world who had things that she did not have. And she wasn't sure how she felt about that or how that came to pass. And she expected her parents to have an answer.
With the benefit of time, what would your answer be today if that same three-year-old asked you that question?
I say, Tali, that's a really great question. Why do you ask?
Oh, that's good. That's good. Put it back to her. I love it.
Tactic, first of all, right? So it gives me a chance to kind of catch my breath, think about, where on earth this might be coming from, but also give her an opportunity to explain, right? Because, it's not totally unreasonable that a three-year-old might come to understand what a summer house is, but I actually had no idea where she got the idea from. And, maybe she thought it was a crazy notion, right? There are some kids, very young kids who examine their parent or their parents and their spending habits perhaps their affluence or what the kids perceive to be extravagance and find it wanting, right? Mm-hmm. They might find that, having a second home or having an extra bedroom even is wasteful when there are people who do not have homes themselves. So maybe that's where she was going with it. I didn't know, but at the time I didn't think to ask, but that's probably how I would handle it now.
I love the title of the book, The Opposite of Spoiled. What does that look like? What does that phrase connote for you?
Well, this all got started for me when I kept hearing from parents who were reading some of the columns that I was writing for the Times, and they saw some of the questions that I was posing to readers that I had heard from either my own daughter or from other older kids, the questions that they were having about money. And these parents were saying to me, Ron, there's a lot of conversation in our communities right now about inequality, and we were wondering if you could give us some ideas about how to talk about this out loud with, mixed social class groupings, or maybe you could come lead a conversation. And I thought, wow, well, that's interesting. If I had to figure out for myself you know, what do all these people have in common, right? The one thing I knew for sure is that nobody wants to raise a spoiled child. Mm. That's kind of where we come from, right? The shared sense that we don't want our kids to be entitled. So if that's the case, and everybody seems to sort of know a spoiled child when they see one, well, what's the opposite of spoiled, right? Because that's what we're all trying to solve for. That's what we're all trying to achieve, to produce, to create an unspoiled child, right? So then I had to make this list for myself of all the values and virtues and character traits that add up to the kind of decent and, you know, grounded little humans that we all want to push out into the world someday. And as I began to assemble that list for myself, the profile of the unspoiled child began to take shape, right? Modesty, prudence, thrift, generosity, graciousness, curiosity, a sense of perspective, patience, perseverance.
Sounds right? like a heroine in a Bronte sister's book or something like that.
Something like that.
Something right? like that. Yes. I mean, my yeah. God, it's 2017 and prudence and modesty. How exciting in an era of Instagram.
Right. You know, I mean, these are kind of classic values. And, you know, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, you know, these are traits that I just think everyone can agree on. Right. So you sort of tick off that list. And pretty soon you realize that you can actually teach those things. You can impress those values on your kids with all sorts of conversations about money. There's a direct connection between talking about money and teaching kids these and other values. And once I had that sorted out, I began to understand what the opposite of spoiled is and could be.
You and I are totally on the same page on the value of conversation. And I would bet we're on the same page about how parents can be a little, I don't know, nuts or neurotic about money themselves and sometimes bring that into the conversation or the lack of willingness to have the conversation because they're neurotic and nuts about money. How do you address that?
Sure. So I agree with you, and I think we should all stop, you know, before we even begin to try to have these conversations with our kids, we all ought to stop and sort of take a deep look inside of ourselves to think about what sort of stuff we might have inherited from our own parents, right? And this is a, you know, good conversation to have with a spouse or a partner if you have one, if you've ever had this conversation before, right? Where you sort of self-diagnose and then diagnose some others, what it was that you kind of picked up from your parent or parents about, you know, their neuroses around money, or maybe they had perfectly healthy attitudes about it. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Very few of us do, but some people are lucky enough to develop those, right? So what did you inherit from your parents? How does that affect your own mental outlook on money conversations? What are you trying to tack against or do differently than what they did? And then once you have your own head on straight, only then can you begin to think about, you know, how you want to have these conversations with your kid. But, you know, it's pretty good to kind of get inside your own head and work this stuff out first.
What are some of the big topics that we should think about weaving in, and when does that weaving begin in your mind?
Well, I think the when happens sooner than you may think, and you do not.
Summer houses at 3 years old, I think, is a great case in point.
Well, exactly, right? You don't get to dictate when this conversation starts or, you know, in what circumstances or context it comes up, right? It may come up with, you know, other people around who you know, who you may not want to overhear your kind of live parenting on the topic. But, you know, I heard from a parent not long after the book came out, whose daughter was 2.5 and wanted to know why she went to work every day when many of the other mommies that she knew did not go to work, right? So again, you know, you don't get to decide when these conversations happen, and you don't get to decide what the topics are. Your kids and their curiosity is going to dictate that. So given that they are trying to sort this stuff out sooner than we may think, you know, we have to be ready at the earliest possible moments. So, you know, I get that a lot of this is abstract for, you know, a 2 or 3 year old, but, you know, starting around the time that kids start losing their teeth. You know, if there's a tooth fairy who shows up at your house and that tooth fairy happens to bring money, you know, that may be a good time to start the conversation about, you know, how we save our money and how we spend it and, you know, when and how we give it away to people who might need it more than we do. And then you're off and running.
When do you start talking about specific numbers? I mean, obviously, there's so much of learning that occurs that doesn't require numbers. You can talk about lots of things without numbers. But at some point, you may want to introduce the cost of a house, the what the salary is coming in, how much the mortgage is, how much the electricity is. How do you start in engaging your kids in those in that level of specificity and in what context?
Well, you know, I think when they're in the single-digit ages, they and you are limited by, you know, the extent of their math knowledge, right? You know,
right.
Their addition, subtraction, multiplication skills, you know, those numbers only go so high.
Right. And $100 seems like an infinite amount. You can't even imagine paying, you know, $800,000 for a place to live.
Well, exactly, right? But the big idea here is that we want to introduce them to ever larger numbers once they get used to the smaller ones, right? So you're, you know, graduating from, you know, a piece of candy or an ice cream cone to the toy that they may want, to the first bicycle, to the first phone, to the first car, to the college education. And you're kind of graduating from, you know, the two digit numbers to the three, to the four, to the five. And, you know, if you're unlucky enough to live down here in the United States, you're looking at six figures for college. So that's kind of how it goes, and it's a progression over 15 or 20 years, and you know all along the way you're slowly introducing them to the aspects of adult life that you know correspond with those two and three and four figure numbers. But if we're giving them practice all along, it's not such a stretch to you know once they're in you know 10 or 12 or 14, say begin to introduce them to the you know, three and four figure numbers that may dictate our own, you know, monthly budgets as adults.
Right. And then they can go Instagram your salary to all of their friends because you've disclosed it to them.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, right? Because the thing that many parents worry about the most when it comes to transparency and disclosure is that the kids will blab. But let's be realistic about how much they know and how much they can find out, right? I mean, I was one of those kids who looked up their parents' tax returns when they were in middle school. I literally went into the filing cabinet and grabbed it because I was trying to make sense of all of the fighting about money that was going on
right.
in my household, right? You know, they can look up and figure out all sorts of things. They will be into your bills. They will be looking over your shoulders. They will be, you know, hacking their way into your phones. They're going to know more than you think. So, you know, I think maybe the better conversation to have with them is to say, look, you know, you may want to know, say, what our salaries are. And we absolutely want to give you that information. In fact, we think you are entitled to it because as a, you know, 16 or 17 or 18-year-old who's going to need to make some decisions about what they study and what they might want to do, it's going to be important for you to know what we earn that allowed you to have whatever standard of living that you enjoy now. But you should know, if you share that information on social media or with your friends, it's just going to sound like bragging and you're going to sound like a jerk.
Right.
And that information doesn't have much, you know, currency or value out there. A lot of the people that we know are a lot like us and they're just not going to care about what we have and what we make. So please keep that information to yourself.
Abby has a four-compartment piggy bank, which I love, but one of the compartments is donating, and she has decided she doesn't want to donate money anymore. She wants to keep it all for herself. So that will be a lesson in progress. What would you do with that?
Here's how I would deal with that one. Every single family, if you stop and think about it, has their own history of having been helped itself. So my family's history goes something like this, right? My mom is a survivor of premenopausal breast cancer. She and her friends got together when another friend of theirs was not so lucky and did not survive, and put together a breast cancer fundraising organization that now has raised over $25 million
wow.
over the last 30 years, right? So I got to have a mom because people who were generous before she came down with the disease, you know, donated money so that the treatment that she got back in 1979 at Northwestern University was good enough to allow her to continue staying alive, right? My wife, her grandmother, is a Holocaust survivor, right? Literally ran across Europe away from Hitler and his goons. So there's a reason why we have a particular interest in, philanthropic interest in our household in refugees. I was a scholarship kid all through middle school, high school, and college. I only got to go to the schools that I attended because other people there had been generous before me, right? So our 11-year-old daughter, she knows all of those stories, and she understands that there is a direct connection between the way that we give and the generosity that we feel and the goodness that has been bestowed on us, right? So, you know, with a child, it might be as simple as thinking about the things that he or she enjoys doing the most and how generous people have made those things possible, whether it's a children's museum or a renovated park or a school that she attends or something like that. There's almost always a way to draw a direct line between the things that you enjoy or the mere fact that you're still alive and somebody else's generosity that you can mimic yourself.
We just have a couple minutes left, but I want to get to one other concept you've talked about, and that is artificial deprivation. I love it. Now, in talking about that, I want to acknowledge that for the people who have artificial deprivation, they have a certain economic stability. They're not living paycheck to paycheck and, you know, at the food bank every other day. But for people who do have that stability, you'd advocate that they need to create some artificial deprivation. What do you mean?
Well, I don't think you have much choice, right? I mean, if you're lucky enough to have more than average and you can get your child everything that that child needs and at least some of what they want, you probably know good and well that getting them everything they want is not going to be good for them, right? So there need to be limits. And, you know, this often comes up, right, when parents say to kids, well, we're not going to get that because I don't have the money or I can't afford it, right? If that's not true, then you're lying. Lying to kids is generally not a good idea. Mm. They will often sniff it out, right? So we need a better reason, which is that, you know, it might go something like this. We're not going to buy those things because, you know, we set a limit for ourselves that what we value this month or this season is making sure that we can go see this theater production that we've been dying to see. Or we want to make sure that we can have enough money for a vacation that we want to take in the summer. And that requires making some choices, making some trade-offs. And it'll mean you know, fewer of these smaller things that you may want to do. But it will mean that we get to do some of these big things, right? And that's going to mean having some limits.
One last tough question. I've only got about 30 seconds for it, but I've got to ask it. Parents go about the parenting job very, very differently. How do you account for different parenting values when it comes to teaching your kids about money?
Well, I think the thing that I would say about that, right, is that, you know, many kids will ask about other families and other parents and the decisions they make and the things that they buy. And I think you can say at a very young age, you know what, I know it may look different and look funny and it may be something that you're jealous of, but we do not in fact know how much other families have. We know a little bit about the decisions they make, but we don't know what they borrow. We don't know why they're making the choices that they make or the pressures or constraints that they may be under. We only know about our own family, and we're going to provide you with enough information so that you understand why we make the decisions that we make, and we're going to try not to pass judgments or make assumptions about other families and what they do.
That's great. Ron, we will speak again because my kid's only 7. I still got a lot of work ahead of me. Appreciate your time.
Excellent. Thank you.
Ron Lieber is a columnist for the New York Times and the author of The Opposite of Spoiled. He joined us from Brooklyn, New York. Stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, Finance It, a Canadian fintech that provides a financing option for small business owners. But next, get smarter about money. That's both an item on many of your to-do lists and the URL for a pretty cool online resource. We'll talk to Tyler Fleming, director of the OSC's investor office. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry on Facebook. We'll be right back.
You're listening listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Very smart, dedicated people work in securities regulation in this country, monitoring, trading, enforcing the law. But mostly they toil in obscurity while the rest of us scroll Facebook and taste test cold brewed coffee. The work of the various securities commissions in this country is important and much more about you than you might think. Tyler Fleming is the director of the investor office at the Ontario Securities Commission. He joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
So what is the investor office? Can we swing by? Do you have cold brewed coffee available for us?
Unfortunately, no cold brewed coffee. But the investor office, so we're part of the Ontario Securities Commission, which is Canada's largest securities regulator. The investor office is the newest part of the OSC, the newest branch. We launched just under 2 years ago. It was October 2015. And our mandate is really to focus the OSC's efforts on retail investor engagement, education, outreach, research. We also have a policy function. We have an oversight function for the Ombudsman's Office as well.
You've redesigned Get Smarter About Money, which is this online resource we've been talking about. It's objective. It is broad. It's deep in what it covers, too. It's got a great RESP calculator. Give us the 411 on what people can expect when we go there.
Sure. So Get Smarter About Money is the OSC's primary consumer education website. It's one of Canada's leading financial education resources. We're about 5 million visitors a year right now. We just relaunched it in June. So it is now fully mobile friendly. It's been completely redesigned from top to bottom. You can access it from any device, anywhere, anytime. So really happy with that relaunch. What you'll see if you go to the website is hundreds of tools, videos, calculators, articles, etc. on a wide variety of personal finance topics. A bit of a focus on investing since that's strictly our mandate, but you will find information on other topics as well because we see it as a holistic issue. So you mentioned our calculators. We have a dozen plus calculators on a variety of topics, RRSP savings, mutual fund fees, whether you should pay down debt or invest. Lots of really great tools that you'll see at getsmartaboutmoney.ca. You'll also find a lot of other information on things such as various savings accounts, various investment products. You'll learn the difference between a TFSA and an RRSP, use a classic example. But then we also have information that's important for us as regulators to get out there and that's not always available on other sites that you might see, whether it's media or financial firms, such as checking registration of firms and advisors who you might be considering investing with. Other information important information on regulatory initiatives that we want people to know, and then also how people can contact and interact with us as the OSC and as the investor office.
There is tons of content out there, and I believe in what Get Smarter is doing. It's got great stuff out there. There's tons of content, but some of it is from private sector companies, publicly traded companies, the banks, whatever, that it has a marketing objective. What are the watch outs on a potential conflict of interest between some of the literacy stuff out there and the marketing objectives of the people who produce it?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people and organizations providing similar sorts of information. As I mentioned, organizations like ours, we also provide information on registration and other things that you might not find elsewhere. I think it's important, regardless of where you're getting your information from, to really think about who's providing it, why they might be providing it, what other information sources out there, double check and get a second opinion is always a good idea. You're right. So there are a lot of similarities, but not everyone's always aligned in the purpose behind it. So I think any smart investor, smart consumer would be wise to think about those sorts of things when they're seeing this information.
You published a report about behavioral insights. What was the objective behind that work?
So behavioral insights, it's a really interesting area that's really taken off, I'd say, in the last 8 to 10 years since the financial crisis. And really what it is, it's an area where we look at why people behave the way that they do. In securities regulation, traditionally, there's been a view that of people as rational actors, right? If you have all the information in front of you, you'll have an efficient marketplace with rational actors. But in fact, what behavioral insights does is looks at the reasons people behave the way they do and actually finds that people are human. Fancy that. To give some examples of some of the areas of behavioral insights, and we're looking at how how this can apply in our own work here. You know, things such as there's various concepts such as anchoring, for instance. So this is where people are given a set of information, various numbers, for example, and how that information is presented ultimately influences how you value something. So a classic example might be if you're presented, say, online with different rates of return, 6, 10, 14%. People might naturally go to the 10% is what they consider a medium rate of return. If you're given 2, 4, 6%, you might think 4 is a medium rate of return. So anchoring is where people, the information that you're presented with helps influence your decisions. Another important area that's another concept that is around status quo bias and inertia. So basically this refers to people's aversion to change. Right. So where you are put or where you are right now, you tend to stay. You see this with, say, the bank that you're with, the investment company that you're with. People tend to stay where they are, absent some strong incentives to change. And that has implications for investments, for savings, et cetera. A whole bunch of concepts in this paper. So the OSC, we're looking at these things and how we can apply them in our work going forward. So we published this report. It's a 115-page report. So if you have a couple minutes there, take the time to read it. It is summarized, though, of course. But we're looking at how we can apply these concepts in our policy and our operational processes in the coming year. And we'll be running some pilot projects and look forward to reporting on that in the future.
Now, other securities regulators around the world have used this behavioral insight work. Can you think of an example of what changes they have made based on BI, like something that they did that would be specific or tangible? Not that you're necessarily going to do, but that they did that was informed by that work.
Sure. So there's a couple examples where various regulators were trying to determine why, refund rates for certain consumers were so low. So it's basically people that were leaving free money on the table. And so there's some tests to use an example of various letters that they used. So one letter might be the standard letter that they use to inform consumers of these refunds. Another one might use some behavioral concepts to see if there's a different result. So another concept is around social norming. And so if people are told that, well, you're one of only 1% of people who do not take this refund, or all your neighbors or all your friends are taking this refund, but you're not, people might be more likely to then act differently. And in fact, the results of tests like that did show that there was a significant difference in the take-up.
Interesting. Now, you've got a new series of videos on your site. One line struck me in one of those videos. It says, the investor office wants to share your voice with the boardrooms of Bay Street. It's a lovely phrase. It's great for the video. It's great marketing. But what does that actually mean?
So we're kind of the interface for retail investors in a variety of ways. I mentioned some of our activities. I think a big part of what we do, if I could take a step back, reflects how the retail investment landscape has changed so much in, say, the last 20 years, right? More and more people are responsible for their own retirements. The pension plans are changing or disappearing. Technology is changing. Social media is changing. At the same time, markets have become more complex. And regulators have really come to realize there's a need to have retail investors participate more in the process of designing policy, more in the process of informing the things that we do. So as part of what we do, you mentioned, share their voice with the boardrooms of Bay Street. That's everything from sharing what we hear when we're out in the community, conducting research and publishing those findings, really acting at that interface for retail investors and helping to ensure that their views are reflected in the work that we do.
Interesting. Tyler, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Tyler Fleming is the director of the Investor Office at the Ontario Securities Commission. Stay with us. Coming up, Tyler will be back to answer the Moolala questionnaire. But first, getting real about a new reality in real estate. In markets like Toronto, not every sale involves a bidding war these days. Now, I've written a couple of books. You can order them online. The first is called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Real estate is a national obsession in Canada. No surprise, given that the price gains in Vancouver and Toronto have been ridiculous, insane, off the charts. But new regulatory measures and a recent rate hike may have changed the dynamics a little bit or a lot, depending on where you live. We're going to look at the Seller Psychology with David Coffey. He's a sales representative at Bosley Real Estate in Toronto and a blogger on all matters real estate. He joins us now. Hello.
Hi there.
Disclaimer, this is a national show. The dynamics differ dramatically, but your experience largely reflects Toronto. Any other disclaimers here?
No, that's about it.
No, that's the big disclaimer. Yeah. Okay, so my neighborhood is one in which people talk about real estate all the time, in the bars, at the playground, in the schoolyard, all that. And talking about selling prices was a real point of pride for people. So they'd be like, ooh, I sold my house. I'm so amazing. I got $1.2 million or whatever. So I was taken aback recently when a seller in our neighborhood got coy about his selling price. He wouldn't talk about it. Have you seen this shift? Are we starting to see the bravado of I'm so amazing, I sold my home for $1.4 million to I only had one offer, therefore I can't talk about it?
Yes and no. I mean, we've seen the shift definitely at the higher end of the market because the market has shifted since in Toronto since the Ontario rules came through with the foreign buyer tax and the rent control. So we're seeing a definite switch from the heights of February where you're getting 33% higher than the year before, which got everybody very excited, right? And then you have the sellers going, wow, look at these price changes. I need to put my house on the market. So they all rush in to put their house on the market. And then the buyers say, wait a minute, this is crazy. And, you know, these changes come in and they go, maybe we just need to step aside and see what happens.
Do you think it's fair to say that we are seeing a shift in the way the seller relates to their sale price? It's different because in the heyday of the bidding wars, there was this, I would say, inaccurate reflection of their self-worth that was tied up in the fact that they got $300,000 more than asking. Like they were like, woo, look at me, I'm awesome. And now the inverse of that, this is my hypothesis, the inverse of that is, you know, we sold our house, but we actually only got one offer and we got asking here. Mm-hmm. And they are almost embarrassed about that.
Yeah, I think for a long time, because it's been a seller's market for so long, it feels as if it's almost effortless. And if you want to put your house on the market, you know, often put it just below market value and people bid and it goes crazy and it goes way over. And then you go out and brag to your neighborhood about all these great prices. And I think there is a moment right now where in some markets you'll see the buyers are like, what's happening? This isn't selling in a week. They're confused. They don't know what to do either. But, you know, it's temporary, I think, unfortunately. I think it's going to start shifting. I'm seeing it already. There's a lot of buyers. What happened with them is they actually didn't end up selling at all. So
a lot of sellers, you mean?
A lot of sellers have not ended up selling at all. So you see, this spring having a lot more terminated listings, like two or three times more than last year.
So this means they put it out there. They didn't get the bidding wars that they wanted. So they just take it off the market.
Yeah. So there's no, they can't brag. But at the same time, you know, it's not desperate. They don't have to sell. So they go, well, you know, I don't have a good story here. The timing isn't right. I'm going
to
wait.
And I don't have to sell.
Really, the only people who had to sell were the ones who bought already and needed the money from the sale of the house.
How do you shift sellers' expectations here? Because I'm sure, I mean, you're a realtor, but you're also kind of a life coach for some of these people, probably. You're dealing with marital dynamics and you're dealing with their hopes and dreams. How do you shift their expectations?
Well, I think you really have to talk to them and figure out their motivations for selling, right? And some of them are moving. If it's a lateral move and you're making a lateral move in a market that's, let's go back to March, for example. If it's so difficult to buy a house and you plan on selling your house and buying another one, then you have to plot out a strategy to buy that house. So you probably want to buy first because it's tougher. And then you might want to sell second because it's really easy back in March. Now you may have different advice depending on when you want to fire off. So if you want to fire off soon and you live in a certain house that's, let's say, over $2 million and it's up north, then that's going to be tougher to sell right now. That's the market that's had the biggest hit. So you may have to have a strategy of selling first. You may want to list at a price and have offers anytime. You may not hold back offers. So you might just switch your strategy.
As a seller agent, so I know you do both, but as the seller agent, how has your job changed in the last 3 months?
I think it has to do with really, really understanding the market. And I think people want to pull in – people won't let go of March. They want it. They want March back. And you really have to pull in comparables to their homes that are recent, that are in the last month or two. But it varies, because if you're in, you know, the lower end of the market, you know, under 600,000, let's say, you know, I've been in bidding wars with 12 other people for a condo under 500 square feet. So that market is still quite strong, right? So it depends on who your seller is. But you do have to have them looking at recent sales. And it's like a slow understanding, right? Some of them are panicking too. They're going, oh my God, it's just going to fall and fall and fall and fall and fall. And I'm like, I don't think so. So, you know, that mentality takes place too. So you just have to follow their neighborhood and just feeding them, hey, this is what's happening, this is what's selling. So they have a...
One of the phrases that I picked up in one of your blogs was, you have to be able to negotiate. What does that even mean? I mean, because that was not a part of the transaction in March. It's like, I'm waiting for a home study. Well, good luck to you. You're not getting this house if you're waiting for the inspection report. Yes. Home inspection.
Yes.
Home inspection. So what does negotiating mean today?
Well, like I said earlier, it was effortless on some. It was almost like you were following a script. You know, we're going to accept offers on Tuesday. You might get a bully before then. So people's expectations were, I'm just going to sit back and people are going to pitch themselves at me and all I have to do is pick, which is really quite easy. But I think the psychology this spring was that, you know, what if you don't get any offers? What if there's a bunch of offers and you don't get what you want? Like, I think you have to be willing to go back and forth and negotiate on things that are like the closing price. You know, on things like, the closing date, your price. And some of these things take a couple of days. It doesn't happen all in one night, as I think we were expecting. You know, I think people have to, you know, sit with things for a while and say, oh, can I do this? Maybe this will work better. You have an immediate emotional response. Then you think for a while and decide, you know, maybe it's better to go and, you know, give a little here. And then the buyer has to give a little, and hopefully you meet somewhere in the middle.
The pricing really is art and science, and the art of it has changed with the market dynamics changing. How do you set prices these days? What's the thinking?
Well, I think the psychology for a lot of sellers who didn't get caught up in the spring was to wait. So, you know, when things started slipping and sellers would say, I want to sell in June, I would say, you know, maybe you may want to consider waiting, depending on their circumstances. So I think my suggestion was to let this thing play itself out with the foreign tax, the foreign buyer's tax, and see how long it takes. Because in Vancouver, it took about 6 months to play out. And that would leave us in October. So if people could wait, I would say wait and see what happens. I can't guarantee that's going to be the best solution. But I'm already seeing buyers coming back a little bit more. So that's what I would suggest off the top.
Is it fair to say that your job is harder now than it was 3 months ago? Does it feel harder?
It feels different.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think, you know, and to be fair, I work with buyers and sellers. So working with a buyer in March was hard. It was, you know, you felt like that's where you feel like a life coach. That's where you feel like you have to prep somebody else with a market that's just galloping away out of control. It feels more comfortable to me now to work in this kind of climate.
Right.
There is some negotiation and you can work with people.
And they can actually go back to their car after touring a house to think, do I want this house or not? Instead of, I need a certified check for $100,000 or I'm going to miss this one.
Yes, but I still think it might be a blip. I don't think we're going to go back to having, you know, anytime soon, you know, a month where it's 33% higher than last year. And I just don't feel that's going to happen again. So I think, you know, that's been tamed. But I think we're going to go back to bidding wars again. I think that's coming.
Gosh, well, I'm glad you got your vacation while you could. Because if you're right, that's it for you for the rest of the year. David, thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
David Coffey is a sales representative at Bosley Real Estate in Toronto and also a blogger on all things real estate. Stay with us. Coming up next, FinanceIt, a new Canadian fintech, helps small businesses offer clients ways to finance big purchases. We'll talk with the CEO, Michael Garrity, and Tyler Fleming answers the Moolah La questionnaire. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this radio show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The stifling humidity of an extra sticky summer's day has descended upon you and your entire family. Yesterday, you had a working air conditioner to save you from losing your ever-loving mind. But today, you don't because it's broken. You need a new air conditioner now, like right now. But you can't afford one unless you can get financing. Michael Garrity is the president and CEO of Financeit, and his fintech is out to make consumer financing easy and accessible. That sounds like a marketing selling line. Michael, hello. You can picture what it's like on a hot summer day. That should be the pitch.
I like it. Now, it could also be the middle of winter. February in Edmonton would be equally compelling as
right.
a picture.
Hopefully it's a heater we're talking about there. Consumer yeah. financing has been around since the General Store on Little House on the Prairie. If yes. you remember that show, you old enough to know that show? Yeah. What is different with Financeit than the ways that people could borrow money to buy big stuff?
Sure. I think what we're trying to do is to make the entire process a lot easier. So it's really a merchant who's out talking to you about your broken air conditioner unit or your faulty heater in the middle of winter. It's something they care a lot about. It's their home. So you're going to call somebody out. You're going to get an estimate and you're going to get a big price tag. And it's a likely purchase that you weren't thinking about 15 minutes before the thing broke. And now you're going to have to figure out what your budget is. And really what we do is we make virtual budgets available that can be delivered through a mobile app in your home by that guy that's giving you the estimate.
What did the merchant do before you? Did they say, sorry, go to your bank and get a home equity line of credit? Or did yes. they have another consumer financing offer? It was just cumbersome.
I think either one of those two. Generally, what would have happened with that purchase is that they would have told you how much it was, and then you might negotiate a little bit on what the price is ultimately going to be, and then you're going to have to come up with the cash. And whether that merchant accepts a credit card, which then you're going to, it's going to be
pay
good
off
for them.
24% interest.
Right, then you're going to have a 24% interest loan, essentially, that you're going to have to figure out how to then get the cash to pay off. Or you're going to tap into your savings, or if you're lucky enough to have a HELOC or home equity line of credit that has space on it, you're going to go and use that and draw it out of your bank account and essentially make a payment. Any one of those options are definitely not very convenient for you in that moment, other than, let's say, the use of the credit card, but then it's not convenient for you when the money's due.
Yeah. Because you sold your soul.
Exactly. Yeah.
What interest rate does the consumer end up paying? And I know I would bet it's connected to a bunch of different variables.
Yeah. It's, you know, size of the loan is one of the variables. Your credit history is another one of the variables. But we try to aim for, you know, call it 7% to 8% the majority of the time. So the idea
so
here
well
is.
So well below a credit card, but well above a fully secured line of credit.
That's correct. Yeah. So that's a great way to position us. Installment loans across the board are generally fall in that category.
And an installment loan means that a part of the agreement is that it's the same amount per month for a fixed period. It's not.
And a fixed rate, right? So people seem to forget in this really low rate environment that we're currently in, that we're all expected to get out of relatively soon, if you're on a variable rate, and all home equity lines of credit are variable rates. So you're going to borrow a whole bunch of money today and the interest rate's going to seem a little low. And over the next 5 years or 10 years, which yeah. is how long our loans are willing to go for, we give you a fixed rate and a fixed term. So you have certainty of payment. A home equity line of credit could literally go up by 5% over the next 5 years, and there's nothing you can do about
right.
it.
Right. How does the approval process differ than another option like a bank, like getting an installment loan at a bank?
Yeah. So getting an installment loan at the bank normally involves—
You have to go there.
Yeah. You have the physicality of it. You have to make an appointment at some bank. And less people these days actually have a connection to their bank, right? Millennials don't even think about branches anymore. That's not how they think about banking. So you have to go to a bank. You have to make an appointment to go see somebody. You usually have to go in and tell your story or show some things associated with your financial life. And the entire thing doesn't feel very convenient, even if you do get a great rate as a result.
So the consumer gets the air conditioner, hooray for them. Yep. But there are a lot of discretionary purchases that might get funding too. Does that worry you? Does making lending more broadly available worry you?
Yeah, our focus...
Not as a business leader, because of course you want people to borrow and buy stuff, because that's how you make money, but as a human being on this planet!
Well, no, for sure. We specifically emphasize responsible lending. And responsible lending means we won't lend to you if this loan doesn't fit within an affordability criteria for you, or if your credit is so weak that you really shouldn't be borrowing money more money.
What credit score would punt someone out of the line?
Yeah, most people... I'm going to say a number, but most people have no idea when I say this number, what it actually means.
Yep.
Canadians are remarkably oblivious to their credit score. And
right.
I think
they think credit score is a channel that offers sports on television.
That's right.
Or something like that.
Oh, the credit score. Yeah, join us today.
Today on the credit score.
So 640 is our beginning point and higher, which is typically considered prime.
Right. So if you've had a history of not paying off your credit card, you missed it a couple times, and your score is below that level, yeah, you're just not going to be a customer for you.
Yeah. We're going to say we're really sorry that we can't lend to you today. Here are some great ways that you can improve your credit score, which will help you across your life.
Next time. Not this time.
Or find somebody else in your life who can be a co-borrower on this particular loan so that we can still get you this thing and help you to budget for it, which is our value proposition. We just need you to bring somebody else, you know, a significant other, a parent, into the mix who's got better
credit.
Your
dealer, your mafia connection.
I'm not saying anything
things.
Right
no,
now.
No, you are
nope.
not. Very well nope. done. What happens if a customer doesn't pay?
All the same things that would happen with a bank if you don't pay.
You go
or
out and
a credit
break
card
thumbs.
Company. No breaking of thumbs. That's illegal. So we will we'll certainly let you know that you're missing payments or that you've NSF'd the payments that we were meant to take. We want to work with you and find a way for you to get back to making these payments. It's really important for people to understand that when they miss payments, it hurts their credit file. It hurts the way that other people look at them as a financially responsible person. It increases the rates by which they can borrow or makes it impossible to borrow in the future. And that's really the key of the conversation for us, is to make sure people understand that and help them to find a way to get back to making these payments.
Where does your capital come from?
So we have a set of financial institutions, whether they're banks or life cos that we work with. All of them are interested in lending money to good quality borrowers who pay back. And they know how hard it is to reach this part of the market, what's called point of sale lending. So they work with us in partnership. We do all the heavy lifting, all the hard work at the front.
It's an iPad. It's not that heavy.
Oh, it's
really
it's so much thinking
heavy.
Went into the iPad,
I'm
though.
Sure.
So all that part, technology, service, that stuff is hard for a lot of big institutions. So they bring the balance sheet. We bring the operational wherewithal. It's a great partnership.
What are the barriers to entry for the big banks from getting in there? I mean, yeah, I'm not saying it's simple to develop an app, a mobile app, but yeah, lots of them do. Why don't they just do it themselves?
Well, it's a great question, and it kind of relates to an announcement that we made about 6 months ago, where we announced that we actually purchased the division of the second largest bank in Canada, TD. So they had a similar service, home improvement lending. They've been operating it within the bank for the last 10 plus years. They were really struggling to have it grow, to stay up with technology, to give it the focus that it needed within a big bank where they have a lot of big product areas. And this one seemed relatively small and hard work. So we approached them, talked to them about how we could take the business over and add it into our business. We agreed. We announced the financial terms about 6 months ago.
What does the consumer see? Is the air conditioning salesperson saying, hey, I've got financing from Finance It? Or is it
exactly what they say?
They are. That's what they say. In that cheesy voice. Hey,
they don't like that. Have to use that cheesy
but they
voice.
Could.
They could.
I could teach them how to. Hey.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is it entirely in app or is there paper?
We can default to paper. A lot of the contractors that we work with, a little older school,
want paper,
right? And they feel more comfortable with a paper
but
app.
But can it be entirely an app?
Of course.
Can someone sign with their finger?
Sign with their finger on their iPad or in their mobile device without having to download our app at all.
Interesting. Michael, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Michael Garrity is the president and CEO of Finance It, consumer lending on an app. Wow. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire, a series of questions about money. And our guest, Tyler Fleming, the director of the investor office with the OSC. Tyler, just the first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
I'm ready.
What is one topic you could talk about every single day and never get bored about it?
I think the importance of starting early, starting to save early, investing early.
Investing early, investing often. Oh, and the magic of compound interest,
there
right?
You go. There you go.
What is one topic you wish that you never, ever had to write about or talk about ever again?
The warning signs of fraud.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm sure it'll be around for a long time.
And they'll get more creative. At least that's good. They'll come up with new ideas.
Yeah.
Have you ever been caught on one of those fraudulent activities before?
I have not, but I certainly know people that have.
Yeah. I had a super close call.
It can happen to anyone.
I had a super close call. How would you describe your money personality?
I'm a saver.
Twas ever thus?
Yeah, since I was young.
And do you think that is your temperament just coming out of the womb, or do you think that was formed by your life growing up?
I actually think both. I have to credit my parents for sure and instilling in us, my brother, sister, and myself at a young age, the importance of saving and value of money. But I do think it's somewhat in my nature as well.
What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? Now, I've got my expectations set very, very low here as a saver. I'm sure you're not talking about private jets and, I don't know, acoustic guitars. But
I do like to travel.
Okay.
Like to travel more than things. For sure. So I like to have a couple trips, usually a couple trips a year. And then I was thinking about this. I also like avocados. Does that count?
Oh, it totally counts. I would never buy an avocado. Good fats be darned. That's too expensive a product for me in the grocery aisle.
There you go. I'm not big on avocado toast, though.
Right. Because these days you probably have to have your avocado toast. If you did have it on toast, you'd have to have it in private.
There you go.
That phrase has been, appropriated. When do you plan to retire and what will you do?
So that's a little ways away, but in terms of what I'd like to do, I don't see myself just stopping working, right? You hear about people who want to continue doing what they do, maybe just part-time, you can't ease into retirement. That's how I see my retirement.
What has been your worst financial mistake?
Ooh, worst financial mistake.
Again, I've got a low bar here if you're a saver.
Yeah, you know what? I think when I was in university and I had a cell phone for the first time, I wasn't always perfect at getting my bills paid right by the deadline. I was a bit sloppy. So nothing really bad came of it, but after a while, I did get better at my habits.
Did it ever hit your credit score? Do you know?
No, it didn't.
So you avoided that fate?
Yeah.
But you felt guilty and stayed up nights berating yourself. If you landed a huge financial windfall, and I say $25 million is huge, what would you do with it?
So I actually have thought about this before. Not that I think it's going to happen. But
before you answer the question,
yeah.
Do you buy the lottery tickets?
I don't. Although I have been to Vegas and played the slots a little bit.
Okay. So you've got a little gambling cred, like a teeny tiny. Okay, now you're allowed to answer the question.
Okay. I actually don't think I would change too much for a little while because I'd be worried about making any rash changes, any big changes. So I would keep working, I think, probably give some more to charity, but spend at least a year not really changing a lot.
Right. And then maybe in the fullness of time.
You don't want to get overwhelmed, right?
If you could live in one other place, an idea, be as specific as you can, for a year, one other place other than where you live in Toronto, where would it be?
Oh, geez.
You can say Barcelona, even though I would probably say Barcelona, but you can steal that one.
You know, I love Melbourne, Australia. I've been there. It's my favorite city outside of Toronto.
Nice. If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
People would check the registration of their advisor or firm before investing.
We're really?
Constantly feeling that message. Yeah.
Really? Is it that big of a risk?
Yeah. Yeah. People can learn a lot by checking registration, but so few do.
And when you say check it, you don't mean just ask them.
No, I mean go to checkbeforeyouinvest.ca and to get all that information.
Checkbeforeyouinvest.ca. I'm going to have to do a whole segment on that there. Thank you for planting that seed.
No problem.
Tyler, I appreciate your time today.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Tyler Fleming is the director of the Investor Office with the Ontario Securities Commission. That is our program for today. Thank you very much for joining us. You can always listen to past episodes either at iTunes or at moolala.ca. And on that website, you'll be able to listen to just the particular segments that you want if you'd like to do that. You can subscribe to the podcast version of this radio show on iTunes. And you can send your questions, comments, tips, etc., to ask at moolala.ca. At Bruce Celery is where to reach me on Twitter. Facebook, Bruce Celery Moolala. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great day.